Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, University of Missouri history professor John Bullion discusses the debt incurred by the British government in fighting the Seven Years' War in the 1750s and 60s, and efforts to recoup some of that cost by taxing the American colonies, leading to the Stamp Act of 1765. That law required that some printed material in the colonies, such as legal documents, be on paper produced in England and have a revenue stamp. This class is about an hour.
Well, good afternoon, all. Today, I'll be discussing with you an important episode in American history, and one that is somewhat different than those that we've discussed before in this course, because the American colonists are mostly off stage during it, and others in the world do the star turn, particularly politicians in London, who attempt to plan for the peaceful expansion of the British Empire. I think one of the problems that American historians have had, that we've tried to deal with during recent years, is our realization that North America and the United States exists in a much broader world. And what we've tried to do is bring that world into the classroom as we discuss United States history. And you guys already know from your reading and what we've discussed in here that the North American colonies, virtually from the very beginning, were involved in international trade of a variety of sorts, both in the Caribbean and in Europe as well. And indeed, it's interesting to realize that some intrepid New Englanders were actually contemplating trade with Spanish California and all the way to China. In much the same way, Britain's North American colonies were compelled to become involved by the fact that they were British colonies in a series of wars that were fought between the British, the French, and the Spanish. Wars that were fought all over the world and were fought again in the Caribbean and in North America. And of course, as you already know from the reading in Brand's text, the North American colonies, subsequent to the 1650s and 60s, are part and parcel of a British Empire that is becoming increasingly well-defined, at least in the minds of politicians in England, and is defined and informed by the acts of trade and navigation. So, in order to understand American history, and in particular, to understand the history of the American Revolution, it's not merely enough to look at what we discussed last time, the preconditions for that revolution in North America, but it's also necessary to look at the situation from another angle, from another perspective, from the perspective of London, as well as the perspectives of Boston and Williamsburg and Philadelphia and Charleston and elsewhere in North America. And the story really begins with the end of a series of wars between Britain and France, wars that finished in 1762 and 1763, with almost complete British victory everywhere in the world, from the Philippines to Havana in Cuba, from Africa to Indian states and the Indian subcontinent, and of course, most famously and directly for the North American colonies in Quebec, in Canada, with the expulsion of the French from Canada and the decision in London to keep Canada as a British colony. That decision was predicated upon, well, put another way, was inspired by the determination that the North American colonies would be safe militarily in the future from attacks from the French in Canada and from French support to a series of powerful Indian confederations along the North American frontier. Thus, when peace breaks out in 1763, it is a peace which sees Britain and its empire victorious everywhere. And it's that peace which leads Benjamin Franklin to make the statements that I quoted to you earlier, that North America is a rising empire, and even Franklin's prediction that in another 100 years, the seat of empire, by that he was referring to its capital, that the capital of the empire would no longer be London, but it would be Philadelphia instead, because Americans would continue to grow in numbers, in population, in power, and in prosperity. In short, and certainly Franklin looked at it this way, there was every reason to be optimistic about the future of the British Empire if you looked at it from the perspective of North American colonists. From the perspective of London, it was interestingly different, and the viewpoint was, well, considerably more pessimistic. And I think the reason for this can be summed up in pretty simple words. The North American colonies benefited from this war, as in fact did Britain itself, but it was Britain who had to pay for it. And wars in the 18th century, just like wars in the 20th, are expensive propositions. As they would say in the 18th century, they are expensive both in terms of blood and in terms of treasure. And I don't think I have to interpret for you what they were referring to when they talked about blood. It was expensive in lives lost, in wounds, in maimed and injured civilians, as well as soldiers and the rest. Wars inevitably involve hurting people, and they inevitably involve killing people as well. And thus, they involve the effusion, the losing of blood. But I think what concerned the British even more during this period was in addition to the loss of life, was the loss of literally what they referred to as treasure. It was the cost of the war. And I think all of us can understand why. And we're familiar with it from debates in the United States in the 20th century and in the 21st century. Navies cost a lot. Ships cost to build. They're expensive to maintain. They are expensive to repair. They're expensive to improve, the sort of research and development of the day, and they're expensive as well to replace. And this is a constant price that an island nation, and one that depends upon commerce around the world, has to bear. Of course, it's more expensive during times of war when there are more warships and more sailors employed. But nonetheless, even in peacetime, that navy cannot be permitted to simply go completely to rack and ruin and to be mothballed. Professional soldiers are also expensive. Their uniforms cost, their food costs, their muskets cost, their cannon costs, their wagons cost, the horses that carry them are expensive as well, the forage for those horses as well. And all of these expenses were much greater during what amounted to essentially a world war. And during that war, the question which confronted Great Britain constantly during the 18th century was how to pay for it and in what way. Now, what I'm going to give you now is a sort of primer, almost a Dick and Jane version of how governments can pay for war then and probably now. One option is always that governments can bear the cost of war out of current tax revenues. You can, in theory, ramp up increased taxation to the point that you are paying for the costs of navies and armies and the rest as you go along. You're not running any debt. It is literally, you could think of it this way, pay as you go. Another option is to borrow money, to find creditors who are willing to loan you money on the security of future payments. These creditors have to be attracted by the stability of your politics, the strength of your economy in both peace and war, and also are attracted by the likelihood that this government can find an effective way and an efficient way of taxing something and some people sufficiently to make regular interest payments. When creditors believe that, then they are willing to invest in loans to governments. Now, all of you are familiar with the loan problems of the United States of America today. Those loan problems exist, well, because we need the money, but they also exist because there are still people around the world who look at the United States and say, this is a dadgum good investment. These politics seem to be stable. The population seems to be at peace with itself. Americans seem to be willing to pay a certain level of taxation, not above, but up to a certain level. And in many ways, when you compare them to other possible investment opportunities, we are a more attractive long-term deal. Still are, even though we owe, well, trillions and trillions of dollars. In much the same way, Great Britain would try to create a situation in which they could borrow money and in which they were an attractive deal to creditors both internally, other Britons, and externally as well. The third option depends upon a combination of the two, taxes and borrowing. And I think you can probably guess from the way I've gone into it what the British option was. I can assure you that the British government and British politicians, if they thought at all about paying as they go, banished that idea out of their heads almost immediately. To pay as you go, you'd have to tax practically everything in 18th century Britain that creepeth or crawleth or did anything else. You'd have to tax the rich, you'd have to tax the poor, you'd have to tax the middle class, you'd have to tax customs, you'd have to tax sugar, beer, molasses, clothing, fabrics, you'd have to tax land, you'd have to tax windows, there's a tax on dogs, and there's even a tax upon ladies of the night, upon prostitutes, which is conceived of at the time. But that would simply put too much burden on an economy. You'd have an economy that was essentially, insofar as it continued to operate on goods and services, would just be handing money over to the government. It couldn't act in commerce. It couldn't act in internal consumer goods. Not only that, and I don't think I need to belabor this point with modern Americans like ourselves. Taxation is not wildly popular with anybody. Many times we can grin and bear it, but it's not something that causes capering in the streets. Taxation at this level to pay for an expensive war as it goes is going to be so heavy that it is politically unsupportable. The well-to-do, the property owners, aren't going to want to pay it, and the poor are going to be ground by the taxes upon them. So if you even thought about paying for stuff as it went, you just say, that's ruinous. That would leave the economy in a wreck, and it would lead to, no joking, rioting in the streets and revolution in the Capitol. The only option, really, is a combination of the two. And I say a combination because to borrow, you have to have some form of repayment. The collateral for the loan is not only the strength and power in the present and in the future of Great Britain and its economy, it is also the ability of the British government to designate specific taxes to repay specific loans and to commit those taxes to the repayment of the interest for years to come. Thus, to borrow huge sums to pay later rather than as you go does not get you off of the taxation hook completely. To the contrary, it demands that you have to tax and tax more heavily as the war goes on. Thus, paying for these wars becomes a matter of finding the right combination of loans, of appeals to creditors, and the right combination of taxes. For instance, when a gigantic loan had to be raised in 1760 and 1761, the government of Great Britain had to choose a potentially dangerous tax, dangerous politically, dangerous socially, and dangerous in terms of revenue. At that point in time, the only thing that London could think of taxing was, and I'm sure this will resonate with an audience of Tiger fans, the only thing you could tax effectively was beer. Now, beer at that time was not merely a popular beverage. I understand by repute it's popular. And it wasn't something that you drank necessarily to feel better or, in the extreme, to get drunk, although that could happen too. Beer was regarded as a food. And those of you, when you guys go to London, or if you want to, if you lay your hands on some Watneys or something of that nature now, heavy, strong beer in London is not only, in Britain, is not only much more alcoholic, it's also, well, it's more caloric. It literally has bread-like qualities. Before I gave up drinking, I fed myself on beer in London frequently. After work, I hasten to add. Unlike the 18th century, where you'd start the day with beer at breakfast, have beer at break, have beer at lunch, have beer in mid-afternoon, served as coffee in many respects for working guys, and then polish off the day with more beer. Anything that taxes beer, notice, taxes working Britons. And it's something that they want, it's something that they need, and it's also something that governments are very, very reluctant to raise the price of. Because when you tax beer, those who brew it and those who sell it, what they do is, guess what, friends? They pass it on to those who drink it. Same thing then as now. And thus, this was a tax that was dangerous to impose. It was also an attractive tax. Follow along now with me, with their thinking. It was an attractive tax because everyone who was offered the opportunity to loan money realized that if the tax worked, there was no way Englishmen and English women would stop drinking beer in large quantities. It is a tax that practically guarantees that the interest is going to be paid. If you see what I mean? So this is the sort of calculations that go on endlessly at the English Treasury. What sort of taxes can we impose? What sort of taxes will people pay? What sort of taxes can they bear up under? And how far can we go in doing this? At the war's end, the national debt of Britain had doubled in amount. And there was a commitment to higher taxation into the future because, again, follow along, you can't stop taxing beer just because the war is over. That tax is committed to pay for that debt. And if you default on a debt, if you don't make regular interest payments, if you don't start retiring the principal, then who's going to loan you money in the future? You understand what I mean? This is literally can almost be understood in terms of a credit rating. You've got to preserve that credit rating. This, incidentally, is why President Obama and others are concerned when the bond rating, the debt rating of the United States, or of, for that matter, of states, is reduced in value because it makes it harder and more expensive to borrow money in the future. So peace comes, but it's a peace in which heavy taxation stays right there. And that affects the planning for the future. Okay? We're all on the same page now. We've won a great war, but in the course of it, we've put ourselves in a position where Britons will be paying heavy taxes, you know, for 25, 50 years into the future to pay for it. And you can't get out from under these taxes. They have to be paid. Well, why do they have to be paid? The easy answer to that is you have to preserve your credit rating. But why do you have to preserve your credit rating? And were any of them right here, and I ask a question of to them like that, they'd simply say, well, they'd be polite, as Britons are, and they'd probably say, with all due respect, which is British talk for meaning you're a dadgum fool, with all due respect, we have to continue to pay these taxes because there will be another war. And then there'll be a war after that. The French are not going to go away. They are going to be vengeful. They are going to want to win back territory. They are going to want to punish us for what we have done. They're going to cause trouble all over the world as soon as they can start to afford it. And they're bigger than we are. They have more people. They're wealthier than we are. In short, you could just expect within a 10 or 15 year period, we'll be back at war again. I might add that this prediction came true. What was not predicted is that the French would war with Great Britain on the side of rebellious American colonies. And after that war, the war between Britain and revolutionary France lasted roughly from 1793 to 1815, a 22-year war. So they simply plan on the existence of another war, which means it's absolutely essential that you maintain your credit rating with high taxes. And it's necessary that you do things to prepare yourselves for this crisis, which literally is just around the corner. Now, how do you go about doing this? What are the goals of the state in doing this? And they really fall into two great imperatives. That's two, T-W-O. They're also T-O-O, great imperatives as well. One of these is the necessity of security. The other is the necessity for economy. And let's examine what they meant as they looked at these two situations. Security means about what it would today to us. It means that you have to have a military level in which Britain and its dependents, its colonies, are safe from sudden military attack and conquest. You, under this argument, you can't just completely stop having a navy, and you can't stop having an army. It's an unfriendly world, and you have to be prepared. Moreover, the French in Canada, the Canadiens, the habitants, they're French. They're Catholic. The Indians that are suddenly now under British protection have been spending the last 100 years killing Englishmen, English women, and American colonists. You can't just let them all of a sudden say, well, now you're British subjects and you can start from scratch. There has to be an army securing them as well. You can't just walk away from this. There have to be British regulars and British ships there. So there's a certain level of security that just absolutely has to be maintained. And I might add, keeping this credit rating up is part of security too, because you've got to be able to finance a quick expansion of the military effort. Now, economy means, well, a couple of different things. In some cases, economy is the, you know, when we're advised today, well, be economical. What they're really talking about when people advise you to do that is they're saying be prudent, be careful in what you spend. Don't be extravagant. Make sure that you absolutely have to have something. Can you do without this? That's being economical. Economy means that you are looking, if you are a politician, for everything you possibly can that you can cut out of a budget. Now, you don't want to be cutting muscle, but typically what politicians aim for is cutting fat. Frequently, that fat can be difficult to find. But nonetheless, what you're looking for is stuff in the budget that can be safely reduced or ideally done away with. The other thing that economy refers to is the economy of Great Britain. Why should people loan money to Great Britain when it has a smaller population and is less powerful than France? And the answer to that is you loan money to Great Britain because you are impressed with its commerce and its economy, as well as its political stability. You are impressed with British manufacturing. You are impressed with British merchants. You're impressed with the British merchant marine. But all of this hinges upon British trade being protected. And thus, what you're also aiming to do is create a situation in which that trade continues not only at its present level, but grows substantially in the future. That can be a difficult thing to do because the economists of the day, and they included some pretty good ones, including the famous Adam Smith, would say, when you tax heavily, remember what I told you earlier, that tax isn't paid. Let's do beer again. That tax isn't paid by the brewer. It's not paid by the publican. It's played by the consumer, the worker. That worker needs beer, not just because it adds fun to life, but because literally it's a source of nutrition. Gotta have it. Therefore, what this does, and believe me, this is English thinking on it, if the price of beer goes up, it will require employers to raise the wages of working men and women. They've got to have the beer. They've got to be able to afford it. And to afford it, they've got to get more money. When their wages are raised, this raises the price of the goods and services they produce. And if, say, they're producing fabric for trade and international commerce, that means British products are more expensive and less competitive. And I think you guys don't need to be taking econ, whatever it is, to reach the proper conclusion from that. More expensive, less competitive means that Europe's, England's international trade is not going to increase. It's going to remain steady, and it's even going to droop. That means the country is a less attractive proposition for creditors. Dadgum, isn't that a dilemma? You got to tax heavily, but if you do, I'm almost tempted to go colloquial here, you're really messed up because you're messing up your long-term economy, which means it's lessening your credit in the future. But if you don't tax, follow along, you mess up your credit in the present. This falls into the category of damned if you do and damned if you don't. And it really falls into the category of whether, and here I'll put it in terms that American evangelicals of the time would understand, it falls into the category of, do you want to go to hell in a hurry or do you want to go to hell slowly? Do you want to become a second-rate power overnight or do you want it to come to pass in 5 years? And this is the sort of dilemma that they're in. How do you balance economy and security? Now, there were some in Great Britain who simply would say, you can't do it. And some would say, and here comes the decision, some would say, forget this. Balancing economy and security, blah, blah, blah. We need to absolutely emphasize security. We need to keep a large navy. We need to keep a larger army. Indeed, William Pitt the Elder is the primary exponent of this. The guy who saved Great Britain during the Seven Years' War. He essentially would say, you just let the future take care of itself. We need to heighten our security right now against the French. And I think in essence what Pitt was saying, in effect, was, look, spend the money now, be safe, and my guess is that this economy will continue to grow anyway. And as it grows, incidentally, Pitt was right about this, as it grows, British commerce will increase, and you can have them both. But the first priority is security, because the French are dangerous, and they're dangerous right now. And if you're going to, well, literally, put your money anywhere, it has to be for security. Other British politicians would emphasize economy, and they'd say exactly the opposite. Lord, this is the worst thing you could do. The thing to do right now is to cut the Navy way, way, way back. Decommission these ships. Put them in mothballs. Put the sailors on shore. Let them go find jobs. Reduce the army down to the level of the last peacetime army or below it. Cut costs every way you can. And that way you can continue to keep high taxes while at the same time your economy expands. And what they're saying is, we got to take a chance. We have to take a chance on the French not moving that quickly. We need to build up right now the power of our economy again. And what we have to do is say, when the next war comes, we're going to have to be able to expand rapidly from virtually nothing. But that's just a chance that we have to take. Now, these are both viable alternatives. They're both proposed by practical politicians. Emphasize security, emphasize economy. And I don't think you guys have to stretch very far to think of modern day equivalents of this. Do we need an army and an air force at this level? Do we need this? Do we need that? And all the rest. But the choice that was made was, and it won't surprise you again, it's like the choice that was made earlier, is to find some sort of balance between security and economy. Just like you tried to find some sort of balance between taxing and borrowing. Now, I happen to think maybe this is a human way of looking at things. You'll have to forgive me because I've forgotten this poet's name. A contemporary American poet recently wrote a poem on the subject of having things both ways. And the most memorable line in it, clearly it's more memorable to me than the name of the poet itself, is that they say you can't have it both ways, but I only want it both ways. Now, is that not a human reaction? Shoot, I don't want to choose. I want both a birthday every day and good studying for History 1100's midterm. I want all sorts of things. I don't want to have to set priorities or anything like that. And I think it's not surprising that given the choice, and believe me, American politicians as modern as Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon, given the choice, these guys are always going to try to split the difference between two extremes. Same thing happened in Britain. Find a way of balancing economy and security. Is there such a way? And oh my, was there ever? Across the wide ocean are the North American colonies. They are, it's not just you that know what's happened to the colonies during the 18th century. There are more of them. The population is growing by leaps and bounds. They are richer. We have the proof because they're buying teapots and tea and porcelain and fabric from England. They like those consumer goods. They buy them on credit. They can't keep their hands off of them. They want British goods. And in fact, the trade from Britain to North America has grown by leaps and bounds in the last 50 years. Numerous, prosperous. What sort of tax burden do they bear? Light. Not even close to what Britons in Great Britain pay. They've got a system of government, remember we described that too, that seems to bend over backwards in taxing Americans as lightly as they possibly can. So, numerous, rich, relatively untaxed. And they claim to be British subjects. And that's not all. They're the ones who benefited from this last war. They're the ones who got the French removed. They owe us a debt of gratitude. So the conclusion is relatively obvious, isn't it? They have the money. They have the numbers. They are British. They are our dependents. Remember what that means, too. And that means they are sitting there as a source of revenue. This is the way out of the trap. You understand what I mean? You find that extra money. It's not the result of higher taxes in Great Britain, but it's the result of taxes on a people who can, should, must afford them. So what you're really looking at is a way of taxing them effectively. Now, the fact is, the minute you start saying, let's tax them, you raise certain questions. Number one, they don't seem to like paying taxes. And their immediate response is, you have no right to tax us because we're not represented in Parliament and we haven't consented to the tax. Remember again the preconditions of the American Revolution. Well, the reaction to this is relatively straightforward in England. They don't want to pay taxes and they claim they don't have to, that we can't tax them as a matter of right. And if I can wax colloquial again, the answer to that is to shrug and say, oh, come on. What it really amounts to is you guys don't want to pay taxes. You've come up with this excuse of representation and not being subject to direct parliamentary taxation. That's just something you cooked up to try to get out of it. That's an interesting and an intricate argument. We can deal with it in a variety of ways with our own intricate argument, virtual representation as opposed to actual. But when you get right down to it, what most people are about, whether they drink beer or drink cider or eat sugar or drink tea or wear clothes of this sort or that sort or have windows and the rest, is that if you ask them, do you want to pay more taxes? The inevitable answer is, oh, hell no, I don't want to pay more taxes. Tax him, tax her, tax whoever's under that tree, but don't tax me, as the old song goes. That and claims of right occur all the time. It's against Englishmen's rights to charge an excise tax. It's against Englishmen's rights to water down beer. This is just more of the same. They're just trying to get out of it. In fact, this effort, notice, and this is important, this effort makes it more important to tax them because they are denying England's right to tax because they're not accustomed to obeying English law. Therefore, what we have to come up with is a tax that we can collect and prove to them that they are going to pay this tax. Now, subsequently, in some of the early Supreme Court cases, McCulloch versus Maryland and the Dartmouth Bridge Company, John Marshall, the great Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in one of his obiter dicta said, the power to tax is the power to destroy. But it entails that. And in this case, taxing, from the British standpoint, was going to destroy the American myth that they couldn't be taxed by Britain. This is going to refute it. It is going to have a political purpose as well. And thus, it becomes necessary to think about exactly what sort of tax should be imposed. I'm not going to belabor this point over much. The Stamp Act is chosen because it is a tax which really is roughly the equivalent of a notary public seal on official documents. When you guys buy a car or buy a house, you'll discover that the contract that you sign to be legally binding on everyone has to have the notary public seal. That's a stamp. Stamp taxes required stamped paper to be used for land sales, land purchases, all court documents, all customs documents, all bills of credit, all sorts of paper currency. Diplomas are not good unless they're on stamped paper. Marriage certificates are not good unless they're on stamped paper. Playing cards are not legal unless they're stamped. Dice are not legal unless they're stamped, and so on and so forth. You could say that stamping paper taxes virtue, marriage. It taxes vice, cards and dice. It taxes business, land title. It taxes credit relations, banking, and it taxes minds by having diplomas. Now, what gives it its power? A stamp tax enforces itself. You don't have to buy stamp paper, but then you don't have to buy land. You don't have to defend yourself in court. You don't have to get married. You don't have to go to school. If you want to, you can paint yourself blue and go live in the woods or with the North American Indians. But if you want to function in a modern society, you've got to buy that stamp paper. That's why it's the ideal tax, because it's in the interest of the taxpayer to buy it. You know, you don't need armies of collectors. The tax enforces itself. That's the beauty of it. And it is the ideal tax to impose upon people who aren't accustomed to paying taxes to you. They can't avoid it. Now, they may talk about avoiding it. They may say, we're going to do a boycott of it. But once one of them buys a stamp paper, then another one is, then others to protect themselves, and then the whole cycle will begin. And I think you can see why a stamp tax would be peculiarly dangerous to American colonists. It's a trap. In England, stamp taxes were regarded as unfair because they didn't give taxpayers a sporting chance to evade paying. It was just almost impossible to get around them. And to sweeten the deal, all it requires is someone to hand out the papers, and the English were willing to use American colonists to do this. Notice what they're doing there. Remember I described to you corruption in England and the attacks of power against liberty? What they're doing is corrupting Americans. And as some Americans discover you can make money doing this, then others will be interested in it. They'll begin accommodating themselves to Great Britain. And what you start building up is a political machine, one that is against the interests of assemblies and against the interests of local control. It is political in intent as well as fiscal. And once the stamp tax gets collected, then you can impose other taxes. They get in the habit of paying taxes, then you can load on more daring ones. This is nothing less, and I think American patriots understood it correctly, this is literally nothing less than a full-scale attack upon the way business was usually done in the North American colonies. And it is absolutely designed not just to raise a British revenue, but also to begin bringing American colonists under closer and closer control of Britain, making them more and more like Britain. Well, I think you can easily see the results of the resistance to the Stamp Act. It's an attack on local government and persistent localism. It's just obviously that. It's an attack upon consent and representation. It not only weakens the power of governments, but it also takes away a source of revenue from local governments and transfers it to London. It makes it more difficult for local assemblies to support themselves. This is a classic attack by power on liberty, and it can be easily understood that way. And it is a classic attack upon political virtue by encouraging the expansion of British-style corruption and patronage and jobs and with temptations to others. It will reduce the prosperity of the American colonies, and it will make property owners, and here we come full circle, like I told you guys on Monday, it will make them slaves to Britain. And you recall that when they said slaves, they weren't talking about metaphor or anything like that. Thus, the only way this literally, you're either going to roll over and play dead on this tax, or you're going to resist it. And the only way you can resist it is by force and by mass movements and by preventing the stamp paper from being distributed. And that is precisely what happens. There's no debate over tactics or strategy or anything like that. This has to be stopped, and it needs to be stopped cold in its tracks. And that requires rousing the spirit of the people in defense of their liberties. It requires rousing the patriotism and virtue of women as well as men. And it requires absolutely preventing the distribution of the stamp paper. It requires an act that comes right up to the brink of outright rebellion. It requires an attack upon British authority, which in fact is executed and carried out. And the result of it is literally, as I said to some of you before class, it's a perfect storm. It's a perfect crisis. And the British, who had aimed at this as the solution to balancing economy and security, suddenly are confronted with a situation in which they have neither economy nor security where the North American colonies are concerned. Now, I promised you guys a moral at the end of this. I think there is one. Goodness only knows, and I might add, I've spent a good part of my scholarly career studying British politicians. They didn't approach this in a stupid fashion. I mean, I hope that I've demonstrated to you that there is a rational development in the way they thought about this. That this isn't something that they cooked up in their heads. This is the answer to serious problems. And these are problems that they felt absolutely had to be answered for the security and economy and the safety of Great Britain in the future. They found a solution that they thought was perfect because it worked in England. It enforces itself. And thus, this is, again, not something, gee, I wonder if this will work, I'll give it a try. There's no wonder at all it's going to work, except it didn't. So what's the moral of this? These are people who planned carefully, who thought consistently and logically, and who came up with what seemed like the ideal solution, or the ideal plan. It didn't work at all. What exactly are we supposed to make of this? And I think as you go through your education here, to borrow from Andrew Del Banco, there are a couple of questions concerns that you should ask everybody who teaches you and ask yourself as you go along. Show me how to think. Well, British are demonstrating, they're thinking. And show me how to choose. These are the crucial elements of a liberal education and life as a young adult, or for that matter, in this by case, an old adult. Think. Choose. The British have laid out this particular way of doing it. And all of a sudden, what they did is just mess up completely. It's at this occasion that I like to fall back on the wisdom of Charlie Brown in Peanuts when he once opined, we're never so dumb as when we're smart, or when we think we're smart. Or you could use Dr. Samuel Johnson. This has particular meaning to someone who writes for a living, like Laura and Sarah and me. Dr. Johnson said, when you write something that you think is really good, a really great sentence, the next thing you should do is take your pencil and cross that sucker out. Well, he didn't say sucker, but, you know, that it has to go. It's too good. And then there's the wisdom of my late father, expressed a couple of ways. One of the ways he expressed it is, if something is too good to be true, it is. Or expressed more pungently, my father would say to me, don't be so goddamn sure of yourself. And the answer to it is, one of the hardest things for people to learn and to practice is to question your own assumptions, especially when you've taken care of thinking and you're certain you're right. That's the time, a la Dr. Johnson, that you have to say, or a la Peanuts, you have to say, I wonder if I'm being real dumb about this. Or if you're Waddy Bullion, you say, that's too good to be true. What do you mean I can buy a Rolex for $50 on the street from a vendor? That's probably not a Rolex watch. In the case of the British, it is their inability to see how critical consent was to running the British Empire, their inability to take that step and see things from the standpoint of other people, that leads them into their great mistake. Thus, I suspect, the moral of this for me and for you and the rest of us is when we are most impressed with our intellectual brilliance, our political savvy, the inevitable nature of our decisions and the way everything is going to work out perfectly, that is the very time to ask yourself, what can conceivably go wrong with this? Now, sometimes nothing will, but it is the time in which caution is, I could say, tell you, indicated. That is when you truly learn how to think and how to choose. But don't worry, the British are going to give us other examples of messing up, which we will discuss on Monday. I'll see you guys then.
Next week on Lectures in History, College of William and Mary professor Andrew Fisher examines the first nationwide effort in American history to deal with environmental problems such as pollution and natural resource exhaustion. This endeavor, which took place at the beginning of the 20th century, became known as the Progressive Era Conservation Movement. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcast. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcast, or download them from iTunes.